rising anxiety, depression, and burnout. It's estimated one of four Americans may require behavioral health services. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, my conversation with psychiatrist Jay Falver, host of Matters on the Mind, now a weekly show on WNIN Channel 9. Dr. Falver's show has been on the air in Northern Indiana for more than 25 years, and now he's offering his mental health advice to a new audience here in the Tri-State. He's heard it all, or has he? You may now email questions to Dr. Falver, questions about dementia, ADHD, medications, family issues, addiction, and much more. If you need some professional advice, the doctor is in. 2 Main Street is next, presented by the Berger Wren Group at Bayard Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Well, in The Wizard of Oz, the Scarecrow shares his desire to Dorothy to unravel every riddle if he only had a brain. Our brains are remarkable and complex organs, weighing about 3 pounds, about 60% fat, about the size of a small melon. What goes on inside this mass of fat and water is, yes, mind-boggling. The brain is a command center with billions of nerve cells, from firing signals to control our breathing, heart rate, motor skills, thinking, memory, from head to toe. The cerebrum, cerebellum, and brain stem work in tandem. When all goes well, any scarecrow would love to have a human brain. So who do you call when there's a disorder, trauma, or dysfunction in the brain's biology? Well, we're going to find out. My guest is a psychiatrist who's been reaching out to the public in a TV program on public media, answering questions about mental health for more than 25 years. The show is called Matters of the Mind, which can now be seen on WNIN Channel 9 Thursday nights at 7:30. Joining me now is the host of Matters of the Mind, Dr. Jay Falver. Welcome to a brand new audience, Dr. Falver.
Thank you, David, and what a marvelous introduction.
Well, thank you. I know you like to have a lot of fun with your show, and it's very entertaining. Now, how long has your show been on the air?
We went on the air 28 years ago, David. It started as a program focused on parenting called Modern Parenting. I was asked to host a forum concerning modern parenting. We did that for 13 weeks, and then the producer of the program said, you know what, we just do this on psychiatry. So for 38 weeks, I had topic-focused programs on PTSD, on depression, on anxiety, sleep, all these particular topics. Did that for 38 weeks. And I'd have a patient on, I'd have a therapist on. I did a little intro myself. It took about 4 hours to cut each program each week. Did that for about 38 weeks. And then we came up with the idea, gee, why don't we just allow people to just spontaneously call into the program over the course of time? We allow them to email. We allow them now to text. So there's ways for them to connect with me and ask a simple question. And the whole format of Matters of Mind was inspired really by an NPR program called Car Talk. Have you heard about Car Talk over the course of time, David?
Oh, yeah, a very popular program.
Yeah, frickin' frack. I like how they just informally talked about automotive issues. I don't have any interest in automotive, but I would always be interested in them. Now, they were comedic, but what I liked about what they would do is they would keep their topics very short and brief. They would be very succinct, but they made them interesting. And I thought, you know, as a psychiatrist, this is way back in 1998 we started, as a psychiatrist, could I produce a mental health program where people could simply ask questions? I'm not going to go deeply into their histories like Dr. Laura did or Dr. Phil does. I just wanted to briefly, succinctly answer people's questions as if I was sitting in their living room. And if you look at the set that I use, I'm sitting there. I've got a cup with me. It's got either coffee or diet soda in it. But I've got an ottoman. I've got a footstool. And the reason I have my feet up on the footstool is to help me keep in the mindset that I'm not in a clinical setting. I'm just talking to somebody in their homes. And we're just informally exchanging information. And I'm doing so to keep it not so much high science, but just talk about simple type of questions they might be experiencing on their minds.
And you also have a prop, don't you? A human brain?
Yeah, not a human brain. Yeah, I've had a brain for 28 years now. The brain is larger than the usual brain. But the reason I brought that prop on, David, is because, you know, if I was a cardiologist, I'd have a prop of a heart. If I was an ophthalmologist, I'd have a prop of an eyeball. I thought, you know, we really need to get discussing what's happening in the brain when there's mental health issues. Because when I started this program back in 1998, there were a lot of misconceptions about mental health and a lot of mysteries. And I just take it back to, here's what's happening in the brain when these particular problems are occurring. I don't talk about neuroscience the entire program, but as the topic arises, sure, I'll talk about what's actually happening in the brain. Thinking about the brain as a piece of tissue or organ as you would the rest of the body, because we're very understanding of heart conditions, of kidney conditions, of liver conditions. Okay, now we're talking about a brain condition, not uncommonly when people are having mental health problems.
Now, I was wondering, why psychiatry? You're a medical doctor. Why did you go into this psychiatric field?
I was originally a pharmacist, David. So I was a pharmacist, graduated from Purdue in 1979. I went to medical school after a pharmacy school with the intention of going into cardiology or primary care. I go into medical school, and I graduated from medical school in 1983, and I'm starting to go into primary care. And I'm noticing, as I'm going room to room and seeing patients in family medicine, everybody seems to have some degree of depression, anxiety, insomnia, and the primary care clinicians were very intimidated by those particular conditions. Number one, as a pharmacist, I was always interested and intrigued by neuroscience. But number two, I saw that psychiatric problems were so common in primary care, they need to be addressed more, well, aggressively. And I wanted to have as much knowledge of that as possible. Well, in 1983, when I was considering going into psychiatry, even psychiatrists who interviewed me for my residency said, look, you've got a pharmacy background. You're not going to be using your pharmacy background if you go into psychiatry. Keep in mind, it's 1983. I said, you know, but I'm just so intrigued by the field, I still want to go into it. So much of my training from 1983 to 1987 was in psychotherapy. Then, 1987, Prozac came out. And after Prozac, the whole medication field of psychiatry exploded, such that now we use over 120 different medications in psychiatry. And as you talk to a psychiatrist now, psychiatrists are particularly going to be focused on medication options for patients, whereas therapists, such as master's level therapists and psychologists, are going to be doing much of the counseling in which I was trained.
I know some of the questions I've seen on your program involve medications, a possible mixture of medications, how much dosage to take, and I know you're very comfortable handling those questions.
I want to stay outside my lane. I want to emphasize to people, look, talk to your clinician about this. Here's some ideas. All I'm doing is giving them some ideas. Maybe they felt like they didn't have enough time to ask their clinician about a simple side effect. Last night I got a side effect question about fluoxetine or Prozac with sun sensitivity. It's rare, but it happens, and I told them why it happens. That they might not have been comfortable asking their primary care clinician or their psychiatrist about that. So I stay within my lane in the sense that I don't want to have the patient or have the caller perceive that I'm assuming their care. Mm-hmm. I'm simply trying to elaborate on some of the questions they're experiencing, they're having, and some of the side effects or some of the good effects, for that matter, they might be noticing with their medications.
Now, I'm curious, you've been on the air answering questions from the public for, almost 28 years, you said. Have the questions changed much over the years?
Oh, my goodness. You bet, David. My goodness, the questions have changed dramatically because it's a wonderful time to be alive. You know, we're in the age of information right now within seconds through AI. You know, for good or for better or worse, AI has its role out there, but you can get answers to many, many questions you might be having. People in 1998, it was all about Prozac. Should I take Prozac? Should I not take Prozac? In the 1990s, that was the decade of serotonin, where we talked about this neurotransmitter serotonin. Well, now we have Instagram, we have Facebook, we have all this social media. lots and lots of opinions out there concerning mental health. And some of them are very responsible, but my role as a psychiatrist is to put those kind of clips that they see on social media, put them in context, and put them in context and allow people to understand their individual personal situation may differ from that person who did the nice 3-minute video on Instagram.
I'm just curious also, any other health workers in your family?
As a matter of fact, my older daughter is a nurse practitioner. She actually works with me.
Oh, really?
My sister is a nurse, and I had no medical ancestors to speak of. My family was a family of farmers. So I really had no medical people in my background. My sister, my older sister, did become a nurse, so she kind of coerced me into going into medicine and going further in my medical career from pharmacy into becoming a medical doctor. And my older daughter has become a nurse practitioner, and, yep, she continues to work with me.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Greenfield, Indiana, just east of Indianapolis. So that's probably why you notice my Hoosier accent. People notice our Hoosier accents when we go across the country. They think, what is that dialect? We've got a unique accent, especially being from Central and you being from Southern Indiana.
Right, right. Well, listen, we're talking to Dr. Jay Falver. He is the host of Matters of the Mind, a program on PBS stations, and now in Indiana, Southern Indiana as well, here on WNIN. And coming up, we're going to talk about some intriguing questions that you have received over these 28 years. And what are some main mental health issues today? Any new treatments out there? And later, some clips from the show. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is psychiatrist Jay Falver, host of Matters of the Mind, now airing on WNIN Channel 9 Thursday night at 7:30. Dr. Falver answers viewer questions about mental health issues, including a major issue involving children, and that's ADHD. Tell us about ADHD, Dr. Falver.
I get so many questions about ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It's also known as attention deficit disorder in attentive type. But this is something where people are better educated now than they were 28 years ago when I initiated the program, because people wonder, okay, I'm having trouble paying attention to different things. I'm having trouble concentrating. Is it ADHD? Can I develop ADHD as an adult? So number one, with ADHD, you need to develop it in middle school or as a child, and it needs to be there more often than not day by day by day. Now, a lot of things can cause you to have inattentiveness, distractibility, difficulty getting things done, because social media, being on your smartphone for extended periods of time, can draw your attention away from important activities. So we have to kind of sort all that out. As you get older, yeah, your inattentive symptoms might improve because you're in a job situation or you're in a social situation that's more interesting for you, because with ADHD or ADD, if it's novel, challenging, or exciting, you're able to do it. You're going to be able to accomplish it if it's novel, challenging, or exciting. But if it's not, you're easily going to get bored and you're not going to complete things. So many people with ADHD or ADD will notice that they get started on things, but then they can't get things done. Now, the last thing you ought to do is self-medicate your anxiety associated with ADHD with alcohol or marijuana, or common type of substances that people will use, because with ADHD, you'll feel very anxious because you're always running behind, you're procrastinating, and you're not getting things done. So it creates a lot of anxiety for people. People with ADHD are often night owls. They are more prone to be able to study and concentrate when it's dark and quiet, so they stay up late hours and they have a hard time getting up in the morning. You see all these different things going on. You don't develop ADHD in your midlife years. In other words, if you have a woman who comes in to see you, and she's having trouble, and she's in her early 40s, she's having trouble concentrating and paying attention, she's in her early 40s, that might be premenopausal symptoms, it might be low thyroid, it might be something entirely different. So as a medical doctor, first and foremost, I need to sort out, is this person having trouble with attention span, distractibility, are they having trouble getting things done because of ADHD that's been there their entire life, or is it because they're now having a medical condition or even a mood condition like depression, which can cause them to have difficulty with attention span or distractibility. So we have to sort all that out And one of the things I do on Matters of Mind is I kind of go through the thought processing of what a clinician will kind of break down when they're trying to determine should they use this treatment or that treatment.
So what are some common treatments?
Common treatments for ADHD, the ones that work really well, hardly have a stimulant. Stimulants have been around for a long time. Stimulants will work really well for ADHD if you truly have that condition. Stimulants, it sounds weird, but why would you use a stimulant to help somebody who's inattentive and distractible? Wouldn't that make them more hyped up? Well, stimulants are kind of like eyeglasses for the brain. If you have nearsightedness, you put on your corrective lenses or your eyeglasses, it corrects your focus and you can see more clearly. That's the way a stimulant will work for somebody who has ADHD or ADD. They can think more clearly with the stimulant. Now, if you don't have ADD or ADHD and you take a stimulant, yeah, you'll be hyped up and you'll be in some ways more focused on certain things, but you're going to have a lot of side effects of the hyped up feeling, some anxiety, but it can be a pleasurable feeling where you feel happy in some cases. That's not good, because to maintain that kind of sense of joy and happiness from a stimulant, if you don't have ADHD, you got to keep going up on the dosage. So that's how people get addicted to stimulants. During the pandemic, during the COVID pandemic restrictions, is pretty much all bets were off in terms of prescribing across the country. So a lot of people got this drug called Adderall. Adderall was being prescribed all over the country during the COVID pandemic. And what happened, a lot of people did indeed get in trouble with it, with addiction. They were short supply on it. My office quit prescribing Adderall probably 15 years ago because we saw that we just had better things to prescribe. But there are many stimulants to use. There are long-acting stimulants that stay in the system throughout much of the day. There are non-stimulant medications. So there's a lot of medication treatment for ADHD. And then coaching, just basic coaching for ADHD is very helpful. And the first part of coaching is get your priorities in order, write a list of what you have to do first, second, third, and get that first thing started and completed before you go to the second thing, the third thing. Many people with ADHD will say they get started on something and they go to something else, then they go to something else. So next thing you know, they've got six things partially done, but nothing completed. So there's coaching that can be helpful for ADHD as well.
Now, also anxiety and depression, I mean, these are constantly with us, seems like more now than ever. How do you deal with those?
People will often ask me, David, do I have anxiety or depression? And I'll often say yes, because anxiety and depression are often along a continuum. What often happens, well, you'll have some life circumstances occur that make you anxious, and you feel anxious and nervous, and you worry, and next thing you know, you're not sleeping so well because you take those anxieties to bed with you, and you're worrying throughout the night, that keeps you awake. So anxiety often leads to insomnia. If you have prolonged insomnia, you'll often have disturbances with depression, because depression is a condition where you're not coping with your life circumstances adequately because you don't have stress resilience. In other words, you can't put up with stuff so well. And that occurs with prolonged insomnia. If you don't have adequate sleep, you don't recharge the coping areas of your brain as you should. That will set you up for depression. So you have this cascade of anxiety, insomnia, depression, and we've got to get that all under control. For instance, if you see a psychiatrist, one of our psychiatric vital signs will always be, how are you sleeping? And we're going to ask details about your sleeping. Do you get to sleep? Do you stay asleep? Do you feel refreshed the next day? We're always looking for conditions like sleep apnea, a medical condition where you may be snoring or pausing your breathing. That's going to affect your mood and concentration the next day. So we'll often hear about those particular conditions, and we're trying to do what we can to correct the anxiety, the insomnia, depression, both with medication and with psychotherapy and medications.
What about questions you have about suicidal thoughts? Do you get many of those?
Oh, my goodness, yeah. And it's something that I think as a public service I need to address, because people will wonder about suicidal thoughts. The first misconception out there about suicidal thoughts is if somebody talks about the potential for their committing suicide, that they're just trying to get attention. That's a big, big misconception. No, if somebody is expressing suicidal thoughts, we need to take it seriously, and we need to try to address the underlying problem. People will become suicidal when they lose hope and when they're not enjoying day-to-day activities. So when you lose hope and you're not enjoying day-to-day activities, and put on top of that a lot of agitation and anxiety, that can set you up for suicide. And of course, we always have to remember that if you have a few drinks of alcohol, that will just kind of take you over the edge itself. Alcohol itself will often take a person to the point where they actually make a suicide attempt when they wouldn't have done so otherwise had they not consumed alcohol. So we're always talking about these risk factors that can occur. A risk factor for suicide will be if you have a first-degree relative who committed suicide, who died of suicide. So if you have a mother, father, brother, or sister who died of suicide, that neurobiologically sets you up because there's a neurobiological component that puts people at a higher risk for suicide. We're not at a point where we can do imaging studies or do biomarkers and do blood tests to determine who's going to be more likely to die of suicide than not. But we certainly take the risk factors seriously, and we want to address those.
Now, we talked about mental illness. There are also some issues involving trauma to the brain. How do you handle those?
Yeah, traumatic brain injury. Traumatic brain injury is something we do take seriously. If you've had a traumatic brain injury, especially if you've lost consciousness or spent a prolonged time thereafter in the hospital, that has an effect on a chemical called glutamate in the brain. Glutamate is an excitatory chemical in the brain that if you have a traumatic brain injury, it'll cause an increased amount of glutamate. In some cases, that can cause a seizure, in some cases not, but it can cause you long-term difficulty with irritability, personality changes, difficult concentration, memory problems, and so forth. So we're trying to stabilize that neurotransmitter called glutamate following a head injury. And a head injury can precipitate what appears to be mental health problems later on, too. So we want to address that.
Okay, here's a big topic. I know I'm an older person now, and I had to deal with my mother suffering from dementia. And we all have concerns about, our later years and dementia. Questions about that?
Yeah, we do. The risk factors for dementia, the number one risk factor for dementia, David, is the longer you live. So the number one risk factor for dementia is age. As we get older, decade by decade, all the way up to, if you get to your 90s, you have a 1 in 2 chance. You got a 50-50 chance in your 90s of having some type of dementia. The dementia we talk about the most is Alzheimer's dementia. Alzheimer's dementia is dementia that affects 60% of people. There's vascular dementia, which involves blood vessels. There's Lewy body dementia, Lewy body disease, which is a different type of dementia. So there's different types of dementia out there. But the number one risk factor will be age. Other risk factors can be these apolipoprotein that is a genetic test. And, okay, what do you do about it? I have genetics for dementia myself. You get your genetic testing. It's not going to be definitive. So what you do all you can to have a lifestyle that's not going to put you at risk for dementia. So that means exercise, exercise, exercise. That's often helpful. Socializing, even as you go into semi-retirement or retirement, maintaining social activities, maintaining meaningful, purposeful activities. Retirement, I always mention to people, retirement is not mentioned in the Bible. So retirement is something that is something we shouldn't focus on and we shouldn't address our life goals toward unless you have something to do in retirement. So meaningful, purposeful activities throughout our lives can actually put you at lower risk for dementia. And obviously staying medically healthy, such as mitigating any difficulties with diabetes, hypertension, high lipids probably have something to do with dementia at some point. So we have all these different risk factors we want to avoid or at least decrease the likelihood to try to prevent dementia.
I take a prescription drug called Donsipril. Are you familiar with that?
Donsipril, you betcha.
Yeah. And that's supposedly, I don't know if it actually, the doctor says it can't hurt you.
It came out in about 2001. Aricept is the trade name of that. And you're right, it can't hurt you. All it's doing is increasing the transmission of acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is a chemical in the brain that can potentially enhance memory for somebody who already has dementia. You know, our question 20 years ago was, should all of us be taking it? There's no evidence that if you don't have the onset of dementia, it's going to improve your memory. But you're right. I mean, as long as you're not having any health problems from it, it's a medication many people can take, especially if you've had a family history of dementia. But that's always a debate. How soon and how aggressively should we treat anybody who has a family member with dementia but they don't yet show symptoms? Good question.
Well, I tell you, our listeners right now are getting a good dose of what they can learn on your program, Matters of the Mind. My guest is Dr. Jay Falver, psychiatrist, host of Matters of the Mind, a long-running TV program on public TV, now airing right here on WNIN Channel 9, Thursday night at 7:30. Coming up, how to seek help if you have a mental health issue. Also, some of the unusual questions the doctor has received over the years and some clips from his program. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, my guest is psychiatrist Jay Falver, host of Matters of the Mind, which can now be seen on WNIN Channel 9, Thursday night at 7:30. Now, we've been talking about some common mental health issues: depression, anxiety, suicidal thoughts, brain trauma, and medication managing. So, doctor, are there any new treatments out there for your patients?
We just talked about new treatments last night on Matters of the Mind, David. A treatment that will be coming available in the next couple years can potentially be, drum roll please, low dose microdosing of LSD. What? That's from the 1950s, 1960s. Are we all going to go on trips like they did out there in California with the hippies? No, we're not talking about that. Microdosing of LSD can have some dramatic effects on the brain chemistry and reverse depression and anxiety for many people. Mescaline, hallucinogenic, at low doses, just maybe one or two doses, can actually relieve, potentially cure, post-traumatic stress disorder. You've heard of the GLP-1s for obesity, Ozempic, Zepbound. These are medications that are used for type 2 diabetes, obesity. Well, they get to the brain, and they have some pretty dramatic effects on decreasing food noise, where you have the rumination about eating and eating and eating. And they also have shown that they've had powerful evidence of decreasing craving for alcohol for somebody who has alcohol use disorder or alcohol abuse. So there's a lot of new treatments coming down the line. That's why as I approach the age of 70, David, I can't retire. This is too exciting for me. And I just have fun learning about all this because we've come so far just in the past 25 years.
And new research, I'm sure, is underway all the time, and some exciting advancements ahead of us.
Yeah, we used to talk about serotonin, especially with Prozac. When Prozac came out in 1987, we talked about serotonin, and our treatments all had to do with how do we improve a person's serotonin functioning, and we'd actually tell people, well, it seems like you're a quart low on serotonin. Let's just enhance your serotonin transmission. Now we realize that was a very naive way of looking at mental health problems. It's much more complex. There are over 100 neurotransmitters or chemicals in the brain, and we're getting a better understanding of many, many of them. And our treatments now are used with the expectation that somebody can actually get well with full recovery and going back to work, socializing, having a normal life. We're looking beyond just symptom relief. Now we're looking at actual what's called functional improvement, where somebody's able to get their life back. And as the United States Army used to say, be all you can be. We want a person to reach their full potential as they're recovering from any mental illness.
Well, that is exciting. What about some of the more unusual questions you received over the years?
I can think of some just in the past few weeks. I mean, I always think back to a question of a person who asked me a while back, is it more stressful to rent a house or own a house? I take any questions. And what I did is I turned that question around about the whole concept of stress. So based on your past experiences, based on your ability to cope with different things, based on your current financial situation. And I talked about change and stress and all that. But last night, I got a question concerning the cerebral structure of Spock's brain. Okay, Spock from Star Trek, mm-hmm. Leonard Nimoy. Was his brain likely different than Captain Kirk and Scotty and the doc on the ship? And actually, we talked about the whole persona of Spock. Spock showed very few emotions. He was very logical. And basically, Spock likely didn't have an amygdala. So he talked about the functioning of the amygdala and how the amygdala can actually override logical reasoning. So when you get really anxious and angry and upset about things, your amygdala lights up. Well, Spock likely didn't have an amygdala. So he was able to logically think through problems in such a way when everybody else was freaking out about things. Spock was always the one to be cool and collected. Hey, you know, we can all learn from Spock in that way. I had a person, maybe a year or so ago, asked about Einstein's brain. Einstein actually had a different brain structure. They did a very detailed autopsy of his brain, and somebody's actually a pathologist has kept it. But Einstein had a truly different brain structure. So some people, for better or worse, are wired differently with how their brain functions than others. So I get very interesting outside-the-box questions, and I love those kind of questions because keep in mind the setting of Matters of Mind is merely an informal discussion with a psychiatrist. I'm informally being invited to your home. I've got my feet up on the footrest there. I'm just relaxing. I'm not going to give you a diagnostic assessment during that time of your own personal issues. I'm just going to talk back and forth about things happening in the world right now.
So what is the state of our country's mental health? Give me kind of a brief overview.
Well, I think people are much more educated in 2026 than they were in 1998 when I started the program. In 1998, there was a group called the Scientologists who were very, very prominent. The Scientologists were a mental health cult. The mental health cult of the Scientologists basically dominated many of the airways and much of the public's perception of psychiatry. That's one of the reasons why I started Matters of the Mind. I wanted people to at least have a different perspective, and I wanted to give my take on what's happening in mental health as opposed to them being flooded with this information from this outside source. I think people are much more educated now on various conditions. They know there are treatments available, and they're willing to maybe pursue different treatments. So that's the good aspect of it. On the downside, well, social media, and that's pretty much the obvious response there. Social media will have a big impact, especially on the mental health of adolescents and young adults, because they will compare themselves to others on social media. Everybody's having a good day. Everybody's living their fullest life, and you wonder, well, what's the matter with me? So it can be very discouraging, very disheartening. Social media with adolescents, my goodness, there's so much bullying going on in back and forth. So on one hand, social media can be very, very productive. It can be very encouraging in some ways, and it can be educational, but you have to be so careful with it. And keep in mind, those algorithms on social media, they really do exist, where social media will track what you're watching, and they will keep feeding you things along those lines. And that's why social media viewing can be so addictive, and you keep watching it and watching it and watching it. Next thing you know, 2 hours have gone by. I do tell people when they get on social media, don't do it late at night. Do it during the daytime and limit yourself to no more than 30 minutes. It's so easy, especially when you're depressed, when you're anxious, you're feeling badly about yourself, to get on social media, stay there, and get stuck there for so long a time, and next thing you know, your day hasn't been very productive.
Let's celebrate the wonders of the human brain. It's a fascinating fatty organ, and what excites you about the human brain? I know you're learning something every day, probably.
It's 60% fat. So if somebody calls you a fathead, David, they're giving you a compliment.
Right.
But it's very unique. And it's one of the mysterious aspects of the body. This is why so many doctors don't go into psychiatry, because we don't have blood tests. We don't have biomarkers. We don't have imaging like x-rays where you can diagnose different conditions. So there's a lot of ambiguity in psychiatry, and that's one of the things that intrigues me. And it's intriguing for me because I've been a psychiatrist now for almost 40 years. The things that I'm seeing now in research and in technical advances start to make sense. And I start to realize why the stuff almost 40 years ago didn't make sense. We now have knowledge of aspects of how the brain functions that we didn't previously. You know, 40 years ago, we thought that if a neuron died, it couldn't be replaced. It was gone. Now we realize that there's something called resilience in the brain, where you can actually have neurons start to compensate for a neuron that's died. So it used to be thought if you had a stroke, that part of the brain could never be repaired or you wouldn't be able to compensate. Now we know that's not true. So there's things now that are so exciting in terms of knowing that we can actually have recoveries in that way.
And, you know, in the field of medicine, psychiatry is relatively new, isn't it?
in the field of medicine, you know, I think the neurobiological aspects of psychiatry is relatively new. In the past, 40 years, actually, since I became a psychiatrist, we have been able to use medications in such a way that we never would have previously. So in the past 40 years, much of psychiatry has become more neurobiological, whereas prior to 40 years ago is mainly the talk therapy, the means of helping people through counseling.
Mm-hmm. Now, we want to get this across that there is a 24/7 crisis and suicide hotline, and you can call or text 988. I'm sure you stress that.
You're exactly right. And I always emphasize that on matters of mind, I'm not a crisis line. I'm just somebody who's been invited to your home to talk for 30 minutes and ask her and just discuss issues concerning mental health. But no, I'm not on matters of mind as a means of crisis intervention. That's where you always need to go through the crisis hotline where you talk to somebody for a more extended period of time. I'm just briefly answering questions. I will answer anywhere between 6 and 12 questions. We're just briefly discussing particular topics. They may or may not entirely apply to one person or another, but it's something that I think, and I'm hoping it can be educational for people.
Now, right now you take calls from northern Indiana, maybe southern Michigan?
Yes, we do get calls and texts live from southern Michigan, northwestern Ohio, and northeastern Indiana. And those texts and calls will come in live during the program.
And now that's being expanded to southwestern Indiana, western Kentucky, and southeastern Illinois. My thanks to Dr. Jay Falver, host of Matters of the Mind, now on Channel 9, WNIN. Check it out, and you can email your questions to Dr. Falver. Thanks again for being my guest.
Thank you, David.
Matters of the Mind is recorded at the PBS studio in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Here's part of a recent episode with the host, Dr. Jay Falver.
Good evening. I'm psychiatrist Jay Falver. Welcome to Matters of the Mind, a weekly mental health program where you get to choose the topic for discussion. Let's start tonight's program with an email I recently received. It reads, "Dear Dr. Falver, I am currently 70 years young. 70 years young. I've been treated for depression since I was 30 years old. I take Effexor, also known as venlafaxine, bupropion, also known as Wellbutrin, and Spravato, also known as acetamine. I also enjoy a beer or cocktail with supper. What are your thoughts about mixing alcohol with medication?" Well, Effexor, Wellbutrin, Spravato, those are medications used for depression. And when you use medications for depression, the general rule of thumb as a psychiatrist will be, if you have one drink, it's going to feel like three. Now, you have to take the use of alcohol with medications in context, because if you're also taking other sedating medications like narcotics, you have to be really careful with any alcohol at all. If you have a prior history of alcohol use disorder, where you've had trouble with alcohol in the past, you probably want to stay away from alcohol. And specifically with this combination, Wellbutrin, Effexor, and Spravato, if you use alcohol within about 12 hours prior to your next Spravato treatment, because with Spravato treatments, as you're aware, it's a nasal spray treatment where you have to sit in a supervised setting for 2 hours at a time. If you have alcohol within 12 hours of your Spravato session, you can have more sedation than you would expect, and even more side effects during the treatment itself. So I'd recommend definitely don't drink any alcohol at all within 12 hours prior to having this Spravato treatment. Talk it over with your clinician about the pros and cons of having a drink, as you had mentioned, a beer or a cocktail every now and then, being aware that with Effexor, with Wellbutrin, you might feel a little bit more loopy than you might expect compared to if you use the alcohol alone. Thanks for your email. Let's go to our first caller. Hello, Larry. Welcome to Matters of the Mind. Larry, you'd mentioned that you don't really want to take any medications. What are some things you can do to help with anxiety in general? Larry, one of the best things you can do for anxiety overall is resistance training or weight training. Now, for many people, they think, my goodness, I haven't lifted weights since I was a kid. Well, if you have a trainer or a coach, somebody who can guide you through the process of weight training, if you can imagine, when you have anxiety, you're kind of tensed up, not uncommonly, and it'll give you difficulty with feeling tired, and that can sometimes even influence your sleep pattern. If you use resistance training, we're talking about 20, maybe 30 minutes of weight training, resistance training of some type, three times a week. That can, in many cases, cause you to tense your muscles while you're doing the resistance training, but then you'll feel more relaxed thereafter. So resistance training is very good for anxiety. Another means of exercise that can be very good for anxiety or depression, for that matter, will be aerobic training. So we're talking about brisk walking, running if you're able to do so, elliptical training, bicycling. Resistance training can help with anxiety, but aerobic training where you're getting your heart rate up, that can be very helpful as well. And the nice thing about aerobic training, that can help you with exercise. What else can you do to help with anxiety? Try to look at the source of your anxiety. If you're worried about things in the future and you're brooding about things that might happen and you have a lot of doubts and you're thinking, what if? Keep a worry diary. In other words, write down the worries that you're experiencing and write down five or six worries at a time. Try to do so earlier in the evening as opposed to later in the evening. And just write down the worries and give it some thought in terms of what you can do about them or what you can't do about them. If you're worried about international events, you personally probably can't do anything about that. So keep that in mind. The nice thing about writing down your worries, Larry, is when you look back on your worries 3 months later, you'll often find all that stuff you were worrying about really never came about. So it's very reassuring for you to write down your worries. So exercise, writing down your worries, trying to identify the source of your worries and do something about it, and identifying what you can do and what you cannot do about those particular worries. Larry, thanks for your call. Let's go to our next caller. Hello, Charles. Welcome to Matters of the Mind. Charles, you want to know about using Depakote for anxiety and does it work? Depakote's been around for a long time. Charles, been around since the 60s or 70s. Depakote is also known as valproate or valproic acid. It's a medication that was originally used for seizures. It's been used for migraines, and it can be used for anxiety. In my experience, Charles, it's kind of harsh because it can give you elevated liver enzymes over the course of time, and we have to watch for liver enzymes for people on Depakote. It can, in some cases, give side effects such as weight gain over sedation, and even difficulty with concentration. So we have a lot of other options out there for anxiety at this point, Charles. We typically don't recommend benzodiazepines such as Xanax, Clonopin, Ativan, Valium long term. We will often recommend medications like anti-epileptic medications that can be used for shorter term for anxiety. And I'm talking about medications such as gabapentin, also known as Neurontin, pregabalin, known as Lyrica. Many times we'll use Trileptal, also known as oxcarbazepine. These are medications that are more tolerable than a medication like Depakote, but Depakote does work, and it actually can be very profound for some people. It's just that we don't use it so much. Now, we often wouldn't use it for women, Charles, because women can, if they're of the age where they can still have babies, it can be fairly teratogenic or problematic during pregnancy, and that's why we often don't use Depakote for young women. But for men, we just have to be aware it has a lot of side effects to it. You do have to monitor the blood levels occasionally as well as the liver tests. Charles, thanks for your call. Let's go to our next caller. Hello, Tom. Welcome to Matters of the Mind. Tom, you want to know about measuring neurotransmitter levels before being on certain medications. We don't measure neurotransmitter levels. I know that's been promoted over the course of time, but bottom line is the neurotransmitters are in the brain. We're talking about serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, GABA, glutamate. All, there's about 60 different neurotransmitters. By the time they get to the brain, to the bloodstream, they're going to be broken down. It's not going to be clinically meaningful when they get in the bloodstream. And we have genetic testing. Genetic testing can look at the degree to which you will metabolize or break down various medications, but genetic testing typically will not predict which medication specifically will work for you for certain conditions. That's where we have to use our clinical judgment. So there are certain genetic tests, and they go by the name of SLC6A1, looking at serotonin transmitter. There's COMT, catechol-O-methyltransferase. That gene will look at how quickly you're breaking down norepinephrine and dopamine in the frontal lobe of the brain. But in general, when we look at genetic testing, we're often looking at situations where we're trying to figure out how quickly somebody breaks down various medications and thereby determine if somebody needs a high dosage of medication or low dosage of medications. But we are not recommending that people get neurotransmitter levels. And I've heard over the 20 years ago, people would get saliva tests for neurotransmitters. And of course, that was found not to be really valid. So I wouldn't recommend that at all. Thanks for your call. Let's go to our next text. Ted, you want to know if Xanax is the best medication for anxiety ever invented. I remember when Xanax, also known as Alprazolam, it came out in about 1983, and it was thought to be a non-addicting medication that was going to replace Valium. Valium, well, I was in pharmacy school when Valium was the number one medication of all medications. Valium also goes by the name diazepam. And in 1979, Valium was the number one medication prescribed of all medications in the United States. So Valium was highly prevalent back in 1979. Okay, a few years go by, Xanax comes out. The difference between Xanax and Valium was that Xanax was less sedating. And Xanax was actually thought to be useful for people who had agitated depression, and it calmed them down. What people love about Xanax will be it works within a matter of minutes, and it'll typically last about 8 hours. What Xanax does, it goes right here to the anxiety volume control. It's called the amygdala. Amygdala in Latin means almond-shaped, and it's right there in the front of the little boxing glove thumb. The amygdala sits there. That's the volume control for anxiety, anger, irritability, rage. That turns down that volume control very, very quickly. Now you might think, well, that's wonderful. Well, here's the problem. With long-term use of Xanax or alprazolam, you can sometimes need more and more and more. And then you get to rely on it where minor anxiety spells or minor instances which should provoke anxiety become problematic for you. So we don't use the benzodiazepines like Xanax so much for people anymore simply because you can get used to them and they can make you a little bit more cognitively dull. In other words, they make your internet speed in your brain a little slower. So the speed of processing in your brain can be slowed with a medication like Xanax. As we get older, we can have more trouble with memory on Xanax and even have more following spells. So we're trying to get people to go different directions than using Xanax long-term for panic. However, not uncommonly, we'll have people just have a few Xanax on hand in case they need to go on a flight, because you got to get on a plane, and we'll tell people to take a Xanax while they're in the boarding area when their flight is announced. We'll have people take a Xanax if they're in a situation where they're backed up into a corner, they're panicking, they're paralyzed with fear and anxiety, because what happens when this anxiety volume control gets really lit up, it'll basically hijack the front part of your brain. The front part of your brain is your thinking part of your brain, your reasoning part of the brain, and if you have overwhelming anxiety, you can be paralyzed with fear and you can't think. That's not good, and it's where Xanax can sometimes break that up. But we try not to use Xanax when people have experienced traumatic situations because it appears to make post-traumatic stress symptoms worse. We have a lot of other options in psychiatry now compared to back in 1983 when Xanax first came out. So Xanax is something that can be very effective for anxiety, but effective medications sometimes, even though they're effective at the time, might not be the best in the best interest long-term for people. Thanks for your call. Let's go to our next email question. Our next email question reads, Dear Dr. Favre, are there any other options besides glucagon-like peptide type 1, GLP-1 medications, if I am struggling with the mental toll of feeling like I'm addicted to eating unhealthy food? You might be talking about food noise, and food noise is where you're thinking and you're ruminating and you're obsessed with thinking about unhealthy food. Now, GLP-1s have been used in those situations, and they tend to decrease the likelihood of food noise. The GLP-1s were studied predominantly with people who did not have mental health issues, however. So the GLP-1 medications, extensively studied in over 100,000 people in dozens and dozens of studies, they didn't show any mental health side effects. That's a good news, but they weren't studied in people with mental health problems. In my experience, some people with GLP-1 treatment, if they have underlying depression and anxiety, they can struggle with having the experience of feeling like they don't care, they don't enjoy things so much, and they just feel kind of blah. So the GLP-1s in some people who have depression or anxiety can notice that. So if you're noticing that you're having difficulty with craving unhealthy foods, keep in mind, okay, the underlying reason for that. Sometimes it can be a dopaminergic issue where you're needing to affect dopamine. Dopamine comes squirting from this little middle part of the brain here called the nucleus accumbens. Makes you feel good, gives you enjoyment and pleasure. And some people, when they're kind of depressed, they will feel like they need to emotionally eat. And if you blast yourself with carbohydrates transiently, blasting yourself with carbohydrates will increase your insulin level. Insulin will pump more tryptophan into the brain. Tryptophan is a building block for serotonin. So indirectly, you're self-medicating when you blast yourself with carbohydrates and sugars. Now, many people will feel good for a while, but then they feel really lousy And it's not unlike alcohol in that regard, where you kind of have the rebound effect and you feel worse the day after experiencing carbohydrates. So I'd certainly talk it over with your primary care clinician about the possibility of you taking a medication that might dampen the likelihood of your needing to eat unhealthy foods. We have a lot of medications other than the GLP-1s that might help specifically in that area, especially if they are going to directly or indirectly affect dopamine and possibly norepinephrine. So we have options there that wouldn't give you the same side effects with GLP-1s, especially in the event if you have any depression or anxiety. Let's go to our next caller. Hello, Tyler. Welcome to Matters of the Mind. Tyler, you want to know, why are you suddenly wired after several months of severe depression? Is that related to your ADHD, or is that normal? If you're wired, Tyler, after several months of severe depression, my first question is, does anybody in your family have similar symptoms? In other words, does anybody in your family have any difficulty with what we call bipolar disorder? Bipolar disorder is where you'd possibly have depression, but then you're going to have some days, if not a week or so, where you're not needing to sleep. You're more impulsive. You do things and say things that you later regret. You have racing thoughts. You will be socially intrusive, and you butt in on conversations totally unlike your usual character. So those are so-called manic episodes. They can follow depressive episodes, and it's about 60% genetic. So bipolar disorder runs in families. So if you notice you're wired, could be related to a mood disturbance all in general. Now, you mentioned you have ADHD. If you're taking a stimulant for ADHD and you're feeling wired, that could be a side effect from the stimulant. So on one hand, feeling wired after a severe depression for several months, that could be from underlying bipolar disorder. On the other hand, if you're taking a stimulant for ADHD, maybe you need to back off on that stimulant dosage under your clinician supervision. So talk it over with your treating clinician to see what kind of issues might be going on there. But I'd say there's a possibility of either an underlying mood disturbance like bipolar disorder or the ADHD treatment making you wired at this point. But those are a couple things that could be possibilities for you.
Matters of the Mind with Dr. Jay Falver can now be seen on WNIN Channel 9 Thursday nights at 7:30. To send a question to Dr. Falver, the email address is mattersofthemind@wfwa.org. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street.